Okay, these are the gatherings of the curious radio amateurs who want to know more about wireless equipment. They check in and give us their name and call letters, and we take them in order and try to answer their questions. No guarantees on 100% accuracy, but the inaccuracies are soon discovered because this is a peer-reviewed group of information. You can go to the website at amateurradio.tangovictor, amateurradio.tangovictor. You can listen to all of the past TechNets for the last 11 or so years. And people do that and inform us of errors that we've made, and we correct them. Let me drop. So the first section of the TechNet is questions and answers for people who do have a question or a comment. The next section is Roy AC2GS with the science talk and mailbag. And people do have questions they want to ask by way of the internet or any other means, because they don't yet have the right equipment to sign in directly to talk to us over the air. And the third section is Paul WS2N with the space report. And NASA and other space agencies have been doing some interesting things we'll be hearing about. Roy possibly will have a puzzle for us tonight. And maybe one of these nights I'll supply a puzzle. A science-like puzzle. So, at this time, we're going to go back to the first section. People signing in because they do have a question or a comment. So if you have a question or a comment for the TechNet tonight, please give me your call letters and name right now. K2I, to be listening.
WP2GXM, Rich, and yes.
Okay, we've got Rich, WP2GXM. Anyone else to sign in because you do have a question or a comment, please give me your call letters and name right now after the beeps.
KC2SHO, John, yes.
Okay, that was John from Los Alamos. And we certainly have him. And I'm hoping tonight that Vito, WP2PJF, will sign in because he's got an interesting thing that we've discussed during the week. So, Vito, are you out there? WP2PJF, K2IW. Maybe Vito hasn't turned his receiver on yet. One last call. Anyone who has a question or a comment for the TechNet tonight, please give me a call letters and name right now. Well, we got more than enough to get started. So, Joe, the B2RYY, how are those electrons and the RF photons, how are they treating you during the last couple of weeks? You got it, Joe, the B2RYY, K2IW.
Good evening, Dick, WP2RYY. Now, here's a question for you. I was off the net. I don't know who's going to be able to answer this, really. I was doing some searching on the over the air with my spectrum analyzer, looking at the TV frequency positive band of TV channels, and it discovered on RF39, which is, let me read my notes here, RF39 is 620 to 626 megahertz. I discovered an emission that seems to be amplitude modulated in nature. That's what I can demodulate on my service monitor. And the band edges seem to be 622.25 to 626.75. So it's not quite the whole width of an entire TV channel, like about 6, give or take. But the information I was decoding or demodulating sounds very similar to what I could decode and have seen up the LTE band above 700 megahertz, going as high as, going up to like 756 where all the LTE stuff is, the different carriers. So, don't know if they're doing any kind of experimenting, and I thought they couldn't put any of that stuff down here for the expansion until all the TV channels were done moving their stuff around. Back to you.
I've forgotten the numbers of the channels that were intentionally left blank because of past services or whatever. And this amplitude modulated signal you see on RF channel 39, 620 to 626 megacycles roughly, you're fairly sure it's not an old-fashioned analog amplitude modulated television signal. You would recognize the characteristics of it. the vestigial sideband, the main carrier, 1 1/4 meg above the lower edge, and so on. So, I guess the main guy who could give us information on this is Eric, KE2EJ. We're really going to miss him. He's now a silent key. Very suddenly became a silent key without a great deal of warning to me. Maybe other people were more informed. So, I'm going to pass it back to you, Joe. Drag your feet in case we got some other television expert out there who can tell us what's going on RF channel 39, 620 megs roughly. W2RYY with some delay. K2RYW in the TechNet.
What I have seen from looking at the LTE part of the band is some carriers, and I don't know exactly who's who up there. I have an idea by frequency spectrum assignment. Not assignment, but by width, who they possibly could be. I think the highest frequency one is like Verizon, the next one down is like possibly AT&T. They seem to have about 9 megs, or double, 4.5 megahertz, worth of bandwidth. You can look on the forward side or the downlink of the base stations, and it looks very similar in content to what I see down on 620 to 626, or actually 622.25 to 626.75, but very similar in content to what I see up there. But I noticed there's other carriers up there that possibly are like either T-Mobile and or Sprint that are only about 4.5 megahertz in bandwidth. So I just, it's a little puzzling. I don't know why somebody would be transmitting in the park until everything is moved around down there, which I think is not, what I see a lot of stuff is just going to
roughly 620 megacycles. When you look across its bandwidth, does it have that characteristic flat top? Mud haircut type thing of a normal 8 VSB signal? Does the spectrum look at all like an 8 VSB spectrum when you look at amplitude versus frequency? Or does it have some other shape to it, Joe? W2RYY, K2RYW?
Well, yes, it does. It's defining out the entire peak envelope area that you see as far as when the emission changes its level, which you don't see on a TV channel. You just get a fixed carrier that you see in level and looks digital, like bartend, what do you want to call it, across a certain part of a frequency. You usually really got an entire TV channel. This does something similar, but what it does, it looks to change in amplitude almost like a CDMA type of transmission, which I have seen elsewhere in other bigger frequency parts of the frequency bands, like down the 870-880 type of frequency band for like AT&T. So I'm not sure what kind of modulation I'm really looking at, but it seems to be AM in nature, because I can demodulate a constant whining type of sound when I put the service monitor on AM modulation. Going on FM, even FM wide, for like 60 kHz demod, you can't hear anything. It just noise sounds like noise.
Yeah, I'm now starting to ask the question, Joe, what's your evidence that it's an amplitude modulated signal? The fact that you go to the AM mode and you hear a whine could be a kind of co-channel interference. And the nature of the signal, it's an amplitude across the frequency spectrum, sounds like an 8 VSB type signal. So, is it possible that it's not really amplitude modulated? The AM you're hearing is really a heterodyne, because there's more than one signal from your location being sensed in that frequency region. Over to you, Joe. K2RYW.
The answer to that would be no, because if I leave the squelch turned down on the service monitor and move the frequency up and down as the whole spectrum of where I see this noise energy being propagated from, the noise really doesn't change. So it's not a heterodyne of one frequency. I hear it any place in this entire space I'm looking on the air. Perhaps one of your cellular experts on the net would possibly know a little bit more about this.
Our cellular expert from Massapequa, I wonder if he's available. Let's see if he's on frequency. T2LI, that's your listening.
Well, I guess not. The only other thing I can tell you is the azimuth from my location where I saw the best or the highest peak of this energy was approximately 315 degrees.
Which sounds like northwest. And is that in the area of that great big tower in New Jersey? I can't remember the name of the town. The name of the town that the tower is in, you know what I'm talking about? Is that their azimuth from you?
Oh, you mean the one in Alpine? No, I wouldn't see signal strength this strong. I was looking at this off my TV antenna. I was getting signals as high as minus 70 dBm as far as, you know, maximum peak energy I could see. It stayed approximately between minus 80 to 75, but sometimes some of the parts of the energy would go up as high as minus 70. And it definitely went down when I went in the other direction. So 315 degrees is about the highest signal strength I saw in that direction.
I think you said 350 degrees, which is almost dead north. Okay, so that's too far north. Alpine is probably more like, what, 310 degrees from you?
No, not 350, 315 degrees.
Okay, 315 degrees. What's your guess as to the azimuth setting for Alpine from you? Isn't it close to 315?
Yes. What makes you believe that this energy is coming from Alpine, New Jersey?
Angle of arrival is a clue. The fact that it's so strong that you think it couldn't be Alpine, I guess there's a possibility Alpine is putting out a very strong signal on that frequency, Joe.
I'll ask again, what makes you think that it's coming from Alpine, New Jersey?
You said it peaked up at 315 and Alpine is at 315. Isn't that a dim clue, if you know what I mean?
Yes, but there's a lot of other stuff. A lot of other terrain between myself going 315 degrees, this stuff, and let's see, Hop Hog, Central Islip, going further north, this stuff into Huntington, west of Huntington, Plainview, possibly, that falls in that path also. So it may not be coming from Alpine, New Jersey. Don't know.
You bring up a good point. So we got a bit of a mystery. You've had mysteries a little bit like this in the past. What eventually happens that allows you to resolve it, Joe? Go ahead. How in the past have you resolved things like this? Mysterious signal.
Well, being that I can't run my spectrum analyzer in my car because it draws a little too much current and had a little an episode trying to run it mobile. One of the wires overheat and makes smoke coming out of my ventilator vents, air vents. So I don't run that in the car anymore. It just draws a little too much juice until I put a AC inverter in there. I have other means of doing that. I can take my R7000 in the car with me and just take a general guess at what I think it is, drive up to a certain location, see if I get a peak energy reading from that radio.
Okay, somebody just said some words on the input frequency without a PL tone on. Who was that? Okay, the person didn't repeat the transmission. I guess with great difficulty you can install a heavy gauge wire from the battery to the cigarette lighter plug or whatever, or just bring an external heavy gauge wire into the cockpit so that you could run your high current drain spectrum analyzer, which I'm guessing is an IFR, a service monitor, I'll say. But the 7000, back on the Citroën's low current, driving around with it, looking at its S meter. You do or don't own a Doppel standard, Joe? Go ahead.
So we'll try this QGZ.
QGZ with now PL tone. Hey, I hope you've been listening, sir, and what's your guess as to what Joe is seeing? Mr. QGZ, C2RIW.
Now, unfortunately, I joined the program already in progress, so I heard a noise. I heard about 315 degrees from him. If you don't mind briefly, I make that go away. Briefly, just summarizing, what are we seeing?
Let me tell him, Dick.
Go right ahead, Joe.
Okay, what I see, Bill, on the spectrum analyzer is the same kind of emitted energy over the air that I see up the LTE band that starts, say, around 710, 712, up, going up to 756 in different segments. I can hear this on a service monitor, my IFR. It sounds like AM in nature when it's demodulated, I see this now on RF channel 39, which is 620 to 626, but the energy does not occupy the entire channel width. Band, as you see, starts at 622.25 and goes up to 626.75 as the top end of the where the energy would like pretty basically fall off. So it looks like it's about 4.5 megahertz in width. And I've seen similar widths up in the LTE band from maybe two of the minor carriers, if you call them, maybe like T-Mobile and possibly Sprint. But they also only have energy. But they also only have energy outputs about 4.5 meg. But the higher in the band, the bigger players, possibly Sprint or Verizon, has carriers about 9 meg in width. Looking at their downlink side of their stations. So I see this now on RF channel 39. I brought it up because I thought nobody was going to be transmitting any of this LTE stuff to go, whatever you want to link to this 5G stuff or whatever. I thought that was not going to happen until about mid-2020 when everybody gets done moving all the TV channels all around the place and everything's all occupied below channel 36 and low.
Repeater, timeout.
Okay, you timed out at the very end. Let me see if I got it. Okay, so you see an LTE, a carrier has, so LTE, you know, it scales, it's made up of resource blocks. You can have either like 1.4, 5.0, 10.0, or 20.0 megahertz, and it all depends on how much bandwidth you have. So, you know, the place that I'm involved with, we have 20 megahertz at 2100, 10 megahertz at 1900. 5 megahertz at 700, and another 5 megahertz at 600, which is now a nationwide footprint. And as long as the incumbent broadcasters have been satisfied, either by having the carrier get them a new channel, new facilities, new antenna, whatever, or they just decide to close down and go away, whatever the agreement they reach, once the channel's clear, the LTE can come up in that channel. Now, that carrier has to protect some of the other TV broadcasters, so it cannot come up market-wide. It really kind of comes up in a smaller area and will be fully deployed throughout the entire network until probably 2020, mid-2020, something like that. But that's what you're seeing. And it's simulcasting all over the place. Well, not everybody's on the same channel, so it's coming out of a lot of sites to your west.
Now, one of his big mysteries is why is he getting it so strong? 315 degrees is the rough azimuth where it peaks up. And he's seeing something like minus 80-something dBm, which implies that it's relatively close to him on the South Shore. Thank you for any comments on that, Bill.
To SAY with a comment.
Doug recognized, but Bill first. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay, so, yeah, it's, I mean, I don't know where it goes or how far east we go on the North Shore. So the channels that are paired with that channel, for that's the downlink, the uplink is on the vicinity of channel 47-ish. And my problem with that band is, well, from the TV broadcaster's point of view, my subscribers interfere with him. But my problem is I have TV transmit in my uplink, so that's what limits me from using that spectrum going east. But I know out as far as the end of the town of Babylon, maybe a little bit into the town of Islip, there is active 600. And if you take that line straight up north, that probably, you know, is where Joe's looking, and that's why it's so strong. You know, it's being aggressively built out wherever it's available. So it's gonna that energy in that same 5 meg slot is going to be on a lot of sites.
Are we seeing the early edge of fifth generation? Is that what's going on here, Bill?
Well, kind of like we, WB2QG said, talked about a little bit before, you know, there's a lot of aspects to 5G, right? There's a different over-the-air modulation scheme that's similar to LTE, but a little more efficient. There's techniques where sub-6 gigahertz, sub-3 gigahertz, there's some pattern steering, some additional MIMO outside of 4 branches. Then there's so there's a millimeter wave aspect, millimeter wave multi, massive MIMO. So what's going on right there is conventional LTE. There is space reserved for a 5G carrier, as far as I know. And that's not 100% squared away yet. But the equipment's in place to turn up. And that'll be a 5G modulation scheme. In the vicinity of that other carrier, I guess.
Bill, I have a question for you.
Okay, I'll bite.
If RF-47 is part of your uplink to possibly the channel I just described earlier, which is RF-39, 620 to 626 megahertz, that channel is not active in this area, but it's active elsewhere, like in Maryland. And a couple of days ago, there was a nice band opening where RF 46, 47, or 49 were coming in from the southwest pretty easily. And I know that one channel is coming from Maryland. That may be the culprit of what you're talking about. That's killing your uplink stuff.
Yeah, I'm not sure if 47's on out east or not anymore. I'm not sure exactly who we're protecting anymore. And, you know, we do get beat up here and there. I got beat up a little bit. Had a couple of sites over in the vicinity of 111 on 600 on I think based on the frantic phone calls I think Saturday night early this morning I guess. Interestingly enough, it doesn't when I do get some stuff there, it doesn't I don't see it everywhere, and I have some remote devices that look spectrally. And they're not seeing the clear signature of a TV carrier. So I'm not 100% sure what's cooking, but, you know, I have a once every 2 week interference problem. That's not a big deal. I just wasn't sure if 47 was still on, because that limits my ability to go east.
RF-47 used to be on the air with WLNY. They have currently moved to channel 27. About 4 or 5 months ago, maybe more, maybe 6 months ago. So they're not broadcasting at 47 anymore. I don't think there's anybody on the island that's broadcasting on those higher frequencies anymore. It's all out-of-state stuff.
2SAY here.
Yeah, let's let Doug say a few words. 2SAY, go right ahead, Doug.
Thank you, Dick. I was going to suggest the fellow that was trying to run a mobile bunny hunt there, and he couldn't power his SDR, whatever it was, his powerful scientific measuring device. I was going to say, the software-defined radio, which you can buy a little adapter for, I don't know, $15 or something like that, hook it up to your laptop, and run some software from a fellow in England. And you can tune the whole VHF band from, I don't know, I guess 60 megahertz or so up to over a gigahertz. So I was just thinking that might be the answer for
them. I have enough test equipment to cover the frequency bands that I want to listen to or observe. The deal is just trying to power them. I haven't put it in order in my car yet. That's the next thing I have to work on, because I can't run it off a DC serial lighter port. Service runs through way too much current over a long period of time. So, and I'm not going to go buy other stuff that's that I don't know anything about. Flipping fine radios. I have a radio receiver that's very good for listening to what I want to listen to. It's about an $1,100 Icon radio. So, thank you.
Joe, when you use your R7000, which doesn't draw as much current as your service monitor, you don't have a a spectrum display like you do on the service monitor. You don't have a spectrum analyzer display. But I guess for you to identify whether or not you're looking at the same signal as you go driving around without the spectrum analyzer display, it's a bit of a problem. And I can see putting an inverter in your car. Well, if you put an inverter in the car, you'd probably mount it in the engine compartment. You can bring a 110-volt cord into the passenger compartment to run the service monitor. So in either case, running a cable from the engine compartment to the passenger compartment of the automobile, whether it's carrying 12 volts at high current or 110 volts after an inverter, in either case, installing that cable, in my opinion, is the hard part. But maybe for you also, you don't really want to go out and buy an inverter. W-A-2-S-A-Y. No, here we go. Demeter R-Y-Y for any further comments on all of above. Teacher I-W, go ahead, Joe.
No other comments. I have an inverter. I've had the inverter for many, many...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I have an inverter, an 800-watt inverter. I'm not going to install it in the engine compartment. I'll eat the darn thing. I'll just bring a nice heavy DC line into the passenger compartment, put it on my... I need to pass the seat and I have an instant 110 volts, so I already have it figured out. It just takes me a little time to do it. I've only acquired this car for a couple of months now.
You're a very unusual guy, Joe. Not many people do, let's see now, digital television DXing, and also a bunny hunting on mysterious signals in the LTE cell phone and digital television frequency region. So you're the only guy on Long Island, I believe, that's doing this, except for Bill. Bill's doing it to make sure his uplinks are not being interfered with. And you're doing it just as a hobby. What's driving you to do this, Joe? And this one, I know that's not an easy question to answer. W-D-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
I'll answer that very simply, with the retort question right back to you. What caused you to build an apparatus to lift the men on the moon? Because probably somebody said you couldn't do it?
In my case, I was working on the group of people, a Tiger team that was developing a super high dynamic range spectrum analyzer starting in 1969. 68, somewhere around there. So we're building the early versions of the AIL 707 spectrum analyzer, and I realized that I'm one of the very rare guys that in that time to have the ability to listen to a 2 gig signal. In 1969, that was a super high frequency. So I was in the right place at the right time to be able to touch equipment on a daily basis that could listen to the frequency region where the astronauts were doing their deep space network frequency transmitting. So I realized that I was one of the very few people on Long Island who had the test equipment that could do it. And I knew it would be an interesting signal, particularly when they were not connected to the networks. And so when they're just talking back to the headquarters at either Cape Canaveral or Houston, Texas. Is it Houston? Yeah, Houston. That's where Building 30 is, the main command center for Apollo. So I knew I was one of the very few people on the island that had the access to the equipment, and I had the interest, so I went and did it. And that's somewhat what you're doing also. You've got the right test equipment that can do it, and you've got the curiosity, and it's a subset of your UHF television DX. Let me drop for a second. One of the things that Joe has brought to our attention on multiple occasions is that the 1 minute or 1.5 minute timer on this repeater may be the right amount of delay time for normal operation during the day, but during the TechNet, the timer is a bit of annoyance because some people want to describe something in a little bit longer windedness, if you know what I mean. So too bad there isn't a way of changing the timer on the W2VL during the TechNet. Now, I was going to ask Bill something. I forget what I was going to ask Bill. Oh, yeah. when you get signals that interfere with your uplink, Bill, for your particular service that you're maintaining, is your major problem something emitting a frequency that it shouldn't be emitting, or is your major problem intermodulation distortion of multiple signals being mixed together at a site that generates third order and fifth order intermod, or generates passive intermod? So which of those two kinds of signals give you the greatest amount of grief and keep you busy during the week? Over to you, Bill. WB2QGZ, K2RIZ, you got it, Bill.
Yep, K2RIW, WB2QGZ. So, you know, I have a, on top of everything else, I have a 2A minus B third order product right in my transmitted bandwidth. And, you know, so I have a, you know, a 1900 something and a 2100 something right in the same antenna, and I'm trying to receive at 1700. So, you know, you could say I PIM test every site every day, right? Because if it's not good, my noise floor reminds me. So we have done an incredible amount of work with an incredible number of fancy connectors and other tools and stuff to clean up a lot of the PIM products. And that's the exit of the PIM, both the internal and external PIM. Is probably 50% of my stuff, and then external interference is the other 50%. And of that external interference, half of it is our intentional radiators, things like BDAs, things like that, and then about half of the rest of the external interference is unintentional things, like, you know, in some cases we found actually some heaters that made noise, which was pretty weird. Pretty common to see oscillating LNAs and TV over-the-air reception antennas, especially in expensive ones, garage door opening devices, especially at the 600, 700, stuff like that. And, you know, the one comment about the SCR, or honestly, even my zillion-dollar Rode PR100, you know, you can't do much without a bandpass filter, right? So, you know, even the relatively expensive equipment, if I'm driving around in the presence of strong downlink, which I almost always am, looking for a weak interferer on the uplink 30, 40 megahertz away, I'll get swamped.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, that Don timer, I wish that hadn't changed. So we lost the last 20 seconds of what you were saying, Bill. Go ahead.
Okay, and maybe it's shorter than usual, and I'll try to keep track of my time here. It was probably something like, of the overall interference, 50% of it is internal and external PIM, and 50% of it is just external RF interference, and half of that interference is probably unintentional radiating devices, and the other half is intentional radiating devices. And as I hang a lot more stuff in the lower frequency ranges, external PIM, stuff like hardware on the tower and all that junk, even behind the antenna, becomes a factor, and that stuff needs to be mitigated with some special fancy plastic and composite stuff to hold cables and antennas.
Yeah, two transmissions ago, you used a three-letter abbreviation that I should know. I recognize it, but I've forgotten what it stands for. BDA. Is that the Bravo Delta Alpha? What does that stand for, Bill?
Yeah, so that's a bidirectional amplifier, and then it's a cellular repeater. So you can hang an antenna outside, stick a patch antenna inside, and this device rebroadcasts uplink outside to the cell site, sends it towards the cell site, and retransmits the cell site back into the building. And there's a lot of consumer places that sell this, and a lot of people put them in on their own. And some of the less expensive ones don't really have any monitoring of their own HEC, so it's if you don't have the correct amount of isolation between the two antennas, it's really easy for them to vomit on each other and just make noise on both uplink and downlink.
So they break into an oscillation. Yeah, bidirectional amplifier. I should have recognized that one. The world of RF is getting more and more complicated. I'm going to turn it over to Joe to see if he's got any further comments before we go to the next person, which is going to be John. And drag your feet in case anybody wants to ask any questions. To me, to RYY, with a little bit of delay. K2RW, what are you going to do next, Joe?
What am I going to do next? I'm going to put an inverter in the car, so if I have to take my service equipment in the car with me to look for something, because of being curious about something, I'll do it. That all comes from when I used to work for the same carrier Bill works for, 15-something years ago. I had an inverter in my company vehicle to do exactly the same thing. I could run 110-volt devices like spectrum analyzers in the vehicle while I was moving without burning up the vehicle. Because if there's a need, you do it.
Yeah, and obvious by your past experience, you're going to be doing more and more bunny hunting on various frequencies, so establishing something so you can take your service monitor, which is the most broadband, highest display, spectrum analyzer display and whatever. Your most desirable piece of equipment in your automobile is that service monitor. So, to establish ways of feeding it from the automobile, it's about time you go and do that. There's all kinds of things I should be establishing on my structure, so I should talk. All right, we're going to go over to the next person, which is John, KC2SHO, from Los Alamos. John, what keeps you awake late at night these days? KC2SHO, K2RW and TechNet. You got it, John.
K2RIW, KC2SHO, evening to you, Dick, and the rest of the net. Just a thought that occurred to me, maybe we could call it a shower thought, whatever you want to call it. Reading articles about, always catching my breath whenever I check into the net, so bear with me for a second. Let me unkey and then I'm starting. Okay, so reading articles about RF ovens, I think I've seen it more than once where they claim that the benefit of an RF oven over a microwave oven has several, or there are several benefits, and one of them the ability to vary amplitude, perhaps vary frequency, but also the article says I started to think about that and thought, well, what those theories actually do, are they leaving out the fact that there are multiple radiators? Or is it possible for phase, I don't believe it is, phase itself with a single radiator to have any difference on the field inside the cooking area? Is the question clear, Dick? K2RW, KC2SHO.
I strongly disagree with that, Rich. N2BO is reporting that you're overmodulating, John. He may hear it that way because it's coming from the other link by way of... he may sense it as an overmodulation. I do not. Don't make any change, John. When it comes to microwave ovens, for decades now, the way to generate a 2250 megahertz, 2.25 gigs, I think is the main frequency, the cheapest way of doing it up till now has been with magnetrons. The good news is that magnetron doesn't cost much because it's mass production these days, and is very efficient. Probably 70-some-odd percent of the DC voltage, or of the primary voltage you put into that magnetron becomes an RF output signal, high efficiency. That's the good news. The bad news is it's very fixed in frequency. So if you want to make it tune to another frequency, let me drop. You can't do it. So it puts out 2250 megahertz, plus or minus a few megs, with a rather high Q oscillating structure. And now, in order to take that standing wave that's inside of that microwave oven, which has got hot spots and cold spots, in order to distribute that, you got to have a turntable or some other kind of a stirrer inside. Okay, for reasons that are mysterious to me, where it's so inexpensive to build magnetrons and solid-state devices that substitute for a magnetron are so much more expensive today and for a long time to come. When you switch over to solid-state as opposed to the magnetron, strikes me a little bit mysterious until we suddenly realize that with solid-state, modern-day circuits, all of a sudden you've got a lot of crazy frequencies you can use that are not licensed, not necessarily licensed. As long as the microwave, as long as the oven itself is a good enough, let me drop. As long as it's a good enough field, an ordinary screen room, as long as it's got enough decibels of isolation, then any frequency in the world you want to use, you can put inside. So now, once you go over to solid state, and you can sweep the frequency, a large fraction of a octave, we'll say, that automatically distributes the hot spots and cold spots, and so now by solid state means, at a millisecond or microwave or a microsecond rate, you can be shifting the frequency, so that even if there's leakage, you're spending very little time at any one frequency to jam any particular service, and now you don't need the turntable, and you don't need the stirrer. So now, I am guessing that that's part of the driving function that's making people invest in solid-state RF generating for the equivalent of a modern-day microwave oven. That's a guess on my part. I'm going to pass it back to you, John. Drag your feet in case we've got smarter people that have got more information. KC2SHO in Los Alamos with some delay. And we'll worry about timing out, John. K2LIW in the tech net.
I think with the delay of RLP will be okay, but I'll leave the gap in there anyway. Yes, very good. All right on point, I think, with what I've read. You know, the ability to stick something in the oven, have it start cooking right away without waiting, varying frequency and things like that to frequency and amplitude, you know, in order to cook the thing all the way through without hot spots, just like you say, all sounds great. But again, the article stated that they could also vary phase. So my question is just varying phase by itself with a single radiator, is there any benefit to that? Or are they leaving something out of the article that there are multiple radiators or some type of array in there? You know, can varying phase change the way something in the oven cooks? Or only if there's interferometry? K2RIW, KC2SHO.
One of the crazy definitions that we don't hear very often is that frequency is something that we measure in hertz, cycles per second, whatever units you like. Frequency is the rate of changing phase. You go to a higher frequency, you're shifting between 0 and 360 degrees on each cycle of the RF you're generating, switch through it more rapidly when you're at a higher frequency. So frequency is the rate of changing phase. To vary the phase, phase only has meaning when you compare it to some reference. So if I'm advancing or retarding the phase of an RF signal I'm generating, it's with reference to some other reference oscillator or some other signal. But if it's only one emitter in the oven, changing phase does nothing. Are they going to put multiple antennas, multiple excitation points inside of the oven? Is that going to do a better job of getting rid of the hot spots? I doubt it. Because the hot spots are a function of what is the final... what's the word for frequency being put into the oven? So, changing phase seems crazy. Unless maybe the particular solid-state amplifier they want to build has a an undesired... Let me drop. So maybe the RF amplifier they're using has a lack of isolation between its input and output, where it might break into oscillation, and if within that amplifier you can change the phase of the feed through signal, you can make an unstable amplifier stable. So for reasons of making the amplifier stable, that's a possible motivation for changing phase if you're changing the phase within the amplifier assembly. But if you're doing it external to the amplifier, and if there's only one emitter in the oven, I'm with you, John. There's no good reason to change phase. Back to you for any final comments on this one, John. KC2SHO, Los Alamos. K2IW, the TechNet.
Yeah, very good. Perhaps they just threw those words into the article. Maybe the author didn't even know what he was talking about. That's always possible. But I read it and went on, and then one day I was explaining it to someone smarter than me, and they basically brought this question up, and I didn't have an answer. And I thought, okay, well, that is strange. Maybe they have a really good point there. Yeah, if you want to close with a final thought, could you tell me more about how phase can affect the stability of the amplifier? That might be my only question at this point. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
When a circuit breaks into oscillation, the circuit has to find a frequency at which the feedback signal is at 0 degrees of phase at the input versus the output. In other words, Every oscillator is an amplifier with a feedback path. That's what an oscillator really is. Without the feedback path, you don't oscillate. So there's got to be a positive feedback path where the amplitude of the voltage is greater than unity, unity or greater, and the phase has to be 0 degrees. You would think you could have 5 degrees of phase error between output and input of a feedback path and establish oscillation. Mother Nature doesn't allow that. It'll switch to another frequency. The circuit will switch to another frequency to where the phase goes to zero. And the amplitude of the oscillator always goes into an amplitude where the complete circular voltage is 1.000 amplitude ratio. It can't be too high, too low, or whatever. In other words, if the feedback signal, let me drop this. If the feedback signal has a gain of 1.5, that means it's being fed a stronger signal than it needs to maintain the oscillation. Therefore, the output will increase in amplitude. Well, the output will always increase in amplitude. You have to have greater than unity feedback amplitude in order to establish oscillation. And you have to have 0 degrees of phase shift. When there's greater than 1.0 of amplitude feedback, the amplitude of the output will increase. The amplitude of the output will always increase until it hits the amount of limiting to where the feedback signal is 1.000 amplitude ratio of what's required to maintain. So it always goes to unity feedback. As such, if you're starting off with an amplifier that you know has 20 dB of excess gain in the loop, you can rest assured that when it's finally settled down, it will be 20 dB into saturation. So by knowing the amount of excess gain of your loop maintaining oscillation, you can predict the exact amount of limiting you're going to get. The limiting is the method by which, let me drop, the limiting is the phenomena by which intermodulation distortion takes place. Limiting, by definition, is a non-linear process. You require a non-linear process to generate second, third, fourth harmonic signals from your original oscillator fundamentals, and it takes a non-linear process to do mixing, to get a 2x3 and a 3x4, a 3x5, and whatever. Intermodulation distortion requires non-linearity. So you can predict the amount of limiting you're going to get. The limiting creates the non-linearity that creates these other spurious signals. But oscillators are peculiar objects. It's an amplifier with feedback. Not many books will explain oscillator from that point of view. Maybe it's my way of internally explaining it to myself, and I hope it's accurate. I've been using that philosophy for lots of years, and up till now it has worked. Do you see what I'm saying on that one, John? I wonder if you've ever read anything like that about oscillators. KC2SHO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, I have read the basics on that, and it has been said to me also by, again, the smarter people around me, because sometimes our systems can go into oscillation. But that is in more detail, and definitely something to think about. I hope when this goes up on the archives, I'll listen to it again, maybe write a few down, or maybe it's already there, maybe you said it in the past. So I'm going to dig deeper into that and try to understand it more. But thank you for the explanation. Much appreciated. I guess that's all I have for now, Dick. Thank you.
Yeah, you've got to be a little bit careful here, John. Not everything we say is 100% accurate. There's some errors. Every technical person, every engineer, every consultant, whatever, has a certain batting average. It's never batting 1,000, never 100%. It's always a little bit of error. I am speculating that if you've got enough phase shift capability within an amplifier, when you've got an unstable amplifier, which means there's a feedback path that shouldn't be there, it's breaking into oscillation. That's one of the definitions of instability of an amplifier. You can either find the mysterious path and shield the living daylights out of it, stop it from being there. That may be a heroic effort. And if you can shift the phase, let me pick a number, 180 degrees from the one that it's oscillating on, in theory, as long as it's not able to swish itself in frequency far enough to bring that back into phase, 0 degrees, then you've made an unstable amplifier stable. So, depending on the frequency region that, depending on the frequency region over which your amplifier has gained, maybe within that frequency region be able to find a way of setting the phase such that an unstable amplifier becomes stable. That is a speculation on my part. I haven't read that anywhere. There's only one point of emission inside of your RF oven, then shifting phase does nothing, and there would be no other motivation for doing it. So shifting phase means they've got more than one amplifier. In fact, there's possibly what's going on. Let me drop, there's something else going on here. To do a good job of heating your food, you'd like to be able to generate, let me pick a number, 700 watts of RF inside of that oven. Okay? Solid-state amplifiers at a 700-watt level are expensive. At these frequencies, 700 watts, solid-state is going to be expensive today and for a long time to come. Therefore, you're going to take a whole lot of lower power amplifiers, maybe 100-watt amplifiers, and combine them. Well, to combine them in one solid amplifier is a difficult process. If you could make a number of individual 100-watt amplifiers in my example, and each one has its own emitter in the oven, and let the summing take place in the oven itself, at the food, as opposed to inside of the amplifier. Summing inside of an amplifier requires quadrature hybrids and it requires all kinds of power summing devices with methods of construction and dummy loads and whatever to allow the summing to take place in the oven. It's a little bit similar to what happens with some kinds of radar systems. There are radar systems where you've got a phased array radar, and you've got an individual amplifier on each individual element of the phased array. So the summing is taking place in space as opposed to in the amplifier. In that particular case, shifting phase to make sure that all of those circuits sum at the right point in the amplifier, in the oven, or to intentionally shift that phase so that the hotspots are being moved around and you're not changing the frequency. Maybe the frequency is crystal controlled. So there's another possibility for why the phase shifting. Because the summing is taking place in the oven, not in the amplifier. KC2SHO, K2RIW, does that make any sense?
Repeater, timeout.
Sorry for the long delay. My nose is IDing. That does make sense, and a new interesting thought for sure. I will also consider that. A lot of I don't know, a handful of companies now, they have a module you can buy for experimenting with RF heating. Perhaps many have had it for a long time, but with the new interest in RF ovens, seems to be something more common, an actual RF oven experimenter's kit, if you will. Might be fun to get one of those and play with that. Also, there's probably going to be a need for some software control. Could be a real fun project, if I can find the time. Real good, Dick. Thank you again. K2RIW,
KC2, SHO. Now, one of the things that I haven't kept track of, John, is the current state of RF ovens. I've been reading articles about companies developing RF ovens, but I didn't know that they had developed them. They're already selling them. And are they selling them at a price that the average consumer is willing to pay? So are there RF ovens out there, solid-state RF ovens, at a price that consumers willing to pay? I'm somewhat doubtful of that, but you're going to tell me. And this amplifier that you can buy, does it have one single output? Is it a module at, say, the 50 or 100-watt level, where you'd need a number of them to really get sufficient heating? So, or is the module itself at a nice number, like, let's say, 700 watts, but has multiple outputs? So, this module, tell me a couple of words on the module you can buy. Did they quote a price?